Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 151, Bursting a Blood Vessel. After he defeated Procopius in May of 366 AD, the Eastern Augustus Valens never again faced a serious threat from inside his half of the empire. By passing that initial test, the word appears to have gone out that he was here to stay and that everyone ought to just get along with their business. However, though he faced no more internal threats during his years governing the Eastern Empire, that did not mean that Valens was not constantly rushing around dealing with external threats. Just as his brother dealt with some new crisis every other week in the West, so too did Valens deal with some new crisis every other week in the East. Broadly speaking, however, there were two big issues that occupied most of his attention: what to do about the Goths, and what to do about the Sassanids. Dealing with both at the same time would prove to be a tricky proposition, and eventually, deep concentration on the latter would lead to a mishandling of the former, and then, yeah, you know the rest. Valens spent the rest of 366 enjoying relative peace in his half of the empire, but in the spring of 367, it was right back into the thick of things. First up on the docket was a punitive campaign against the Goths. Now, as you may have noticed, the Goths have receded into the background a bit after being featured prominently during the crisis of the 3rd century. Successive defeats at the hands of Gallienus and Claudius and Aurelian in the 260s and 270s AD had brought an end to their high-flying partying, and so they had withdrawn back across the Danube to nurse their hangovers. Since those heady days, the Goths had been acting more as trading partners with and mercenaries for the Romans, rather than blood enemies of the Romans. But that was all about to change. Not because the Goths were feeling particularly belligerent again, but because desperate times were about to call for desperate measures. Shortly after Valens became emperor, smallish Gothic raiding parties had begun to make incursions into Roman territory, a problem Valens dealt with by transferring two legions into the affected area. These two legions are famous to us, however, not because of the battles they fought with the Goths, but because as they were passing through Constantinople, they were the two legions talked into supporting Procopius's revolt. When the usurper successfully captured Constantinople, he began casting about for allies, and in an interesting twist of fate, those very same Goths the legions had been sent to subdue turned out to be keen on an alliance. They had always been on good terms with the Constantinians, and with Procopius waving Constantine's standard around, supporting his cause seemed to the Goths like the right thing to do. If he won, then they would be well-positioned for years to come. Except, Procopius didn't win, and after Valens re-secured Constantinople, the emperor was eager to show the Goths just how poor their position now was. With both the initial raids and the support of Procopius to revenge, Valens crossed the Danube in the spring of 367 with retribution on the brain. But retribution was not the only thing on Valens's mind. He launched himself across the Danube not just because he wanted to teach the Goths a lesson, but also because he wanted to make sure that the Goths would not continue to stir up trouble when the emperor inevitably headed back to the far east to deal with the Sassanids. Recall that before he had to return to Constantinople to deal with Procopius, that Valens had been on his way to Syria. Shapur was still riding high from his victory over Julian, and, as you'll remember, the Persian king had taken Jovian's surrender to mean that he now had carte blanche to do whatever he wanted. Territories had been invaded, the pro-Roman king of Armenia had been captured and then tortured and then executed. The border with Persia was where the real action really was. The campaign against the Goths was just a preliminary sideshow. Hopefully a personally satisfying sideshow, but a sideshow nonetheless. driving the point home that the Far East was the critical theater of Valens's territory. At the same time that the emperor was crossing the Danube, Shapur was invading Iberia. Not the Iberian Peninsula, of course, but the, for some reason, identically named region in the Caucasus Mountains, roughly lining up with modern Georgia. In addition to Shapur's general goal of simply controlling more disputed territory, his invasion of Iberia was also undertaken with the specific goal of capturing the dead king of Armenia's son. The young prince was named, and I don't mean to sound rude, but frankly I find this name hilarious, Pap, and he had fled to Armenia following his father's death and was in hiding in one of the main cities of Iberia. Completely eliminating the pro-Roman royalty of Armenia was obviously in Shapur's interests. So the Persian king laid siege to the city that sheltered young prince Pap. Meanwhile, back in the central part of the empire, Valens was finding his campaign against the Goths to be much less satisfying than he had hoped. As soon as the legions crossed over, the majority of the Goths, or at least those Goths who had sided with Procopius, fled up into the Carpathian Mountains to avoid a confrontation. They were led up into the mountains by a charismatic leader named Athanaric, who will, just so you know, pop up repeatedly in our story as we move forward. At least partially aiding Valens in his hunt for Athanaric, though, was another Gothic leader, who will also pop up again and again as our story unfolds, a fierce rival of Athanaric's named Fritigern. Despite their mutual desire to see Athanaric in chains, though, there was just no upside to marching into the mountains to track down some scattered Goths, and so the campaign of 367 turned out to be an empty affair for Valens and Fritigern. The next year was even more frustrating, as heavy rains flooded the Danube and made crossing over an impossibility. Still wanting to ensure that the Middle Empire would remain safe when he eventually headed east, though, Valens hung around and helped direct a complete reconstruction of the region's fortification network. It was while he was overseeing this project that a beleaguered refugee showed up at his doorstep begging for aid. The refugee was, of course, Pap. The prince had managed to slip through Shapur's siege line and was now requesting Valens do something about the illegal Persian aggression. Valens agreed that something needed to be done, and further agreed that with his father dead, that Pap was the rightful king of Armenia. The emperor ordered a couple of legions to escort Pap back to Armenia and see him safely restored to the throne as soon as the next spring arrived. In the spring of 369, then, the focus of the emperor was clearly shifting toward a confrontation with the Persians. With the Danube's water receded, he once again crossed over the river with the overriding goal of quickly bringing Athanaric to some kind of battle, defeating him, and then working out a peace agreement. It didn't have to be the world's greatest peace agreement, but Valens did want it to come after some kind of Roman victory, for obvious political reasons. Obliging the emperor's strategy, this time Athanaric did not flee into the mountains, and Valens was able to track him down. An oversized skirmish broke out, the Romans drove off the Goths, and Valens declared victory. He then headed back across the Danube to Roman territory and summoned Athanaric to come talk terms like a good little supplicant. But the Gothic leader, defeated but not cowed, refused to cross the river, stating that he had sworn an oath never to set foot in Roman territory. Obviously, it was out of the question for Valens to cross back over the river, as it simply wouldn't do for the emperor of the Romans to go call on some Gothic chieftain, so the two sides were at an impasse. But since Valens wanted to get a deal done as quickly as possible, he was amenable to a compromise solution. And so the two leaders met on an island in the middle of the Danube, which allowed both to save face. Once they were across the table from each other, the two leaders hammered out peace terms, which was good, but those terms in the end wound up hurting both sides, which was bad. Athanaric would no longer be required to provide troops for the Roman Empire, and in return, the Romans would no longer recognize the free trade rights of Athanaric's Goths. The short-term result of the deal was that the Goths ceased hostilities, and Valens was able to turn his attention east with something resembling peace of mind. The long-term result of the deal was that Valens had cut himself off from a major source of new recruits for the army, and the Gothic economy was devastated by all the duties, restrictions, and taxes Roman merchants were now able to throw up in their faces. But that was for later. For now, Valens was finally able to turn his attention to the Persian question. When Pap arrived in Armenia backed by Roman muscle, the plan was for him to be simply placed back on the throne. But things turned out to be a wee bit harder than that. When Shapur heard what the Romans were up to, he gathered up a full army and invaded Armenia, easily putting the couple of thousand Roman soldiers who had served as Pap's escort to flight, and the would-be king fled after them. With the Romans gone, Shapur went a little berserk and laid waste to the Armenian countryside, maybe in an effort to get the people of Armenia to blame Pap and the Romans for the devastation. You know, one of those stop supporting the guerrillas and we'll stop bombing your cities kind of things. Or maybe it was just out-and-out terror tactics. Whichever, after Valens concluded his peace with the Goths, he was able to muster a larger force, and in the spring of 370, he sent them to put Pap on the throne of Armenia. This far larger force was quite a bit more intimidating than the previous escort had been, and the Romans succeeded this time in retaking the western half of the country and declaring Pap king. Over the course of the next year, the Roman army pushed steadily east until by mid-371 they were knocking on the door of Iberia. Shapur made a stand near the border between Armenia and Iberia, but in the ensuing battle he was beaten, but not necessarily decisively, by the Roman army. At this point, Shapur found himself in much the same place that Valens had just found himself with regard to the Goths. That is, what he needed right now more than anything else was a quick peace treaty. In the far east of the Sassanid kingdom, the Kushans had revolted, sending the region into chaos. Shapur needed to break off hostilities in the west so he could go deal with the far less stable crisis in the east. The Persian king and the Roman high command at the scene came to terms establishing the pro-Roman neutrality of Armenia, the independence of Iberia, and, treaty in hand, Shapur raced toward India. This would have all been well and good for Valens, had not Pap turned out to be a bit of a despicable jackass. Upon assuming control of Armenia, Pap proceeded to alienate the ruling aristocracy, the common people, and the Roman ambassadors. At some point between 371 and 374, things with Pap came to a head, with the young king's execution of a bishop possibly serving as a breaking point. Valens decided to take care of the problem once and for all. Sick of getting nothing but aggravating reports about what Pap had done now, Valens decided to just start over. He ordered his men in Armenia to arrest Pap and execute him. No one in the country was really a fan of Pap's, so I'm sure Valens was figuring an assassination wouldn't really be too much of an issue. Except that when Shapur found out about it, he decided to make it an issue. The treaty he had signed with Rome clearly stated that Pap was the rightful ruler of Armenia, and that the Romans would stay out of the country's internal affairs. There was a line between Armenia being pro-Roman but independent, and Armenia being merely an extension of the empire, and Valens had just crossed it. So with the Kushans subdued, around 374, the Persian king marched back across his kingdom to once again square off with the Romans over the issue of Armenia. Which brings us to the fateful year of 375 AD. You'll recall from last week that an invasion of Illyria by the Quadi and Sarmatians had dragged Valentinian over to the Danube frontier from his base along the Rhine, and that shortly after his arrival, the barbarian raiders were begging for leniency. The emperor was in no mood to just let them off the hook, though, and so, over the course of 375, he prosecuted a little war north of the Danube to punish the tribes for their aggression. We left off, you'll remember, with the emperor finally accepting the Quadi's apologies after he had kicked them around some. And specifically, we left off with the emperor agreeing to a face-to-face meeting with the Quadi ambassadors before they went home. Now, as we've seen over and over again, Valentinian was a man of pride and a man who was very protective of the awesome stature of the Roman emperor. And he was highly sensitive to any perceived slights to his authority. Not to engage in armchair psychology, but given how often in the last 10 years his will had been thwarted, his demands had been unmet, and his orders had gone unfulfilled, I think perhaps Valentinian had drifted into oversensitivity about perceived slights to his authority. Anyway, for whatever reason, Valentinian made an exception to his general rule of not meeting with foreign ambassadors. And what a fatal exception it turned out to be. The meeting began well enough, with the emperor berating the Quadi for their transgressions, and the Quadi taking it and saying, "Thank you, sir, may I have another?" But then, when it was the Quadi's turn to speak, they did not do what they were supposed to do, and beg humbly for the emperor's continued benevolence. Instead, they took the opportunity to reiterate their original argument, that they had been provoked to war first by the building of Roman forts in their territory, and then by the murder of their king. Upon hearing this, Valentinian's blood began to boil. As emperor, he had already determined the guilt and innocence of the parties involved, and he had determined the Quadi were guilty, and Marcellianus was innocent. To continue to argue otherwise was an insult to His Majesty the Emperor. But then the Quadi ambassadors went on. They reminded the emperor that the Quadi were not some monolithic thing. They were a loose confederation of independent tribes. That while the representatives present fully intended to hold up their end of the bargain on behalf of the specific tribes they represented, they couldn't necessarily guarantee that other tribes not represented would do the same. They mentioned this because they didn't want to get smacked around for something somebody else had done, which was an understandable point. But what Valentinian, already pretty ticked off, heard was, "Oh yeah, by the way, the treaty we just signed isn't actually worth a damn, and we're just going to keep doing whatever we want to do." This was too much for the emperor. He got up and began angrily berating the Quadi ambassadors for their insolence, picking up steam as he went along until he was in the middle of a full-blown screaming rant. At the peak of this tirade, the emperor suddenly paused, and then he fell over. Court officials rushed to his side and attempted to revive him, but to no avail. Valentinian had worked himself up into such a towering rage that he had suffered a fatal stroke. He was 54 years old and had ruled the empire for almost 12 years. His death is by far my most favorite of all imperial deaths. As I mentioned, when Valentinian first became emperor, his legacy is difficult to assess, in no small part because Ammianus Marcellinus, one of our prime sources for this period, clearly doesn't like Valentinian one bit. Marcellinus constantly paints Valentinian as an arrogant, uneducated boor, which he may well have been, but is it safe to assign all the bad things that happened during his reign to the emperor's lack of character? Maybe yes, and maybe no, but we just really don't have that much to go on. What I think is clear, though, is that Valentinian's reign was a transitional period for the West, not at all in a good way, and that the emperor did very little to help turn the situation around. He seems to have spent a lot of time acting like he was living in the age of the Antonines, when the empire was well-run and all-powerful. But he wasn't. He was living in a time when the empire's grip over the provinces was slipping, and, while still powerful, could not simply do whatever it wanted to do. There were chinks in the armor all over the place, and instead of recognizing that obvious fact, Valentinian appears to have walked around like the Roman Empire was still invincible. That said, he was effective, eventually, in dealing with the crises that erupted during his reign. The Alemanni were pushed back, the loss of Britain was staved off, the problems in North Africa, first a corrupt administration and then a local revolt, were both resolved, and just now, the Quadi and Sarmatians were back on the north side of the Danube, even if their attitude had just accidentally killed him. In none of these instances did Valentinian get it right the first time, but in all of these instances, he got it right eventually, and he does deserve credit for that. As I just said, Valentinian's reign was a period of transition for the West, as intensified attacks from the outside exposed the weaknesses of the empire's defenses, and poor administration on the inside exposed the weaknesses of the empire's government. Then, to top it all off, Valentinian's death would mark one of the greatest transitions of all, the transition away from strong imperial leadership. Never again would the people of the West enjoy a powerful emperor ruling in their midst. Mostly what they got after Valentinian was a series of weak puppets, hiding out behind a ring of swamps that surrounded Ravenna, afraid to leave their palaces, and afraid to face the destruction of their empire. We will have a great deal more to say about how and why the Western Empire fell apart, but one of the things definitely kicking around in there was the total failure of the imperial system to produce emperors worth a damn in the West. I don't think this was the biggest reason for the fall, but I do think it was one of the secondary issues that compounded the empire's larger problems. Meanwhile, Valentinian's death could not have come at a worse time for his brother Valens. If there was ever a moment when two strong emperors were needed, then right now was that moment. In addition to the fact that war with the Sassanids was looming once again, a revolt had broken out in Cilicia. Preparing for war in the east meant reassigning troops away from the Danube. The revolt in Cilicia meant reassigning more troops away from the Danube. Pretty soon, the northern frontier was dangerously under-garrisoned. Then, the craziest thing happened. An army of Goths began to mass on the north bank of the Great River. But they weren't looking for a fight. They were asking for asylum. The fearsome Goths asking for asylum? Who or what could they possibly be asking for asylum from? Next week, we will answer those questions by introducing the unstoppable juggernaut known as the Huns, whose irresistible Western migration was about to completely rearrange the face of the Roman Empire. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 152, The Storm Before the Storm. Last time, we left off with the very serious and not at all hilarious death of Valentinian. As I mentioned at the end of the episode, the emperor wound up picking a fairly rotten time to check out, because the empire was about to deal with a crisis that would balloon to such immense proportions that it is often pointed to as the moment when everything really started to go downhill. Could Valentinian have made a difference in how things turned out? Maybe help cut catastrophe off at the pass? My gut tells me that yes, a Valentinian Valens Imperial team does a better job managing the Goths than a Valens Gratian Imperial team. But then again, given how terrible Valentinian was at diplomacy, maybe I've got it completely backwards. Not that it matters. Valentinian is now dead. His brother and son are just going to have to do the best they can without him. Speaking of Valentinian's son, you'll recall from a few episodes back that an 8-year-old Gratian had been elevated to the rank of full Augustus after his father nearly succumbed to a serious illness in 368. Shortly thereafter, Valentinian had gone on campaign against the Alemanni and taken Gratian with him to give the boy his first taste of military life. Unfortunately for all parties involved, Gratian appears to have not at all been suited for soldiering. I'm not sure how exactly you can come to that conclusion about an 8-year-old boy, but by all accounts, Gratian seemed much more inclined towards relaxed cultural pursuits rather than vigorous martial pursuits. The boy's reaction to the campaign was convincing enough to Valentinian anyway that he kept his son away from legionary camps in the future, possibly out of fear that the troops would notice the boy's shortcomings and refuse to accept him as heir when the time came. Despite his efforts to stifle military skepticism, though, Valentinian's fears would be partly realized when the emperor died, though the end result was not nearly as bad as it could have been. When Valentinian marched over to Illyria to deal with the wayward Quadi in 375, he left the now 16-year-old Gratian behind in Trier to maintain an imperial presence along the Rhine. Still in his early 50s, there was no reason to believe that the emperor was going to suddenly drop dead. So when he did suddenly drop dead, Gratian turned out to be an awfully long way from the central imperial court. This distance left an opening that was skillfully exploited by Valentinian's stunned but quick-thinking commander of the imperial bodyguard, Maributus. Not at all confident in Gratian's ability to defend the empire properly, Maributus and his fellow generals contrived to push their own authority at Gratian's expense. But they couldn't just declare themselves masters of the empire without sparking a civil war, so they went and snagged Valentinian's youngest son, the 4-year-old Valentinian II, and proclaimed the toddler Augustus before the assembled troops in Illyria. Ostensibly, this proclamation was to head off agitation from within the rank and file to name their own successor, but most modern scholars tend toward the belief that the elevation of the youngest Valentinian was a naked power grab by the senior generals. Obviously, it would be more than a decade before Valentinian II could think for himself, so who would run things until he grew up? Why, his noble and dedicated servants on the general staff, of course. This unilateral elevation hung in the air for a moment as everyone waited to see how Gratian would react. When he heard the news, however, the 16-year-old simply bowed to what he figured was the inevitable result of his own low standing with the army. To protect what was left of his dignity and to avoid open conflict, Gratian accepted his brother as co-ruler, nominally putting the toddler in charge of Italy, Illyria, and Africa, with the general staff in charge of day-to-day operations. So as 375 wound down, the empire now had three Augusti. Valens, who was off in Antioch preparing for war against the Persians, Gratian, who was in Trier keeping an eye on the Alemanni, and Valentinian II, who settled into Milan to play with his toys and enjoy the blissful ignorance of childhood for a few more years. While the new imperial arrangement was settling itself, though, storm clouds were brewing up in the north. These storm clouds had actually been brewing since about 370, but it wasn't until 5 years later that the dark shadow finally crossed over into Roman territory. The name of this dark shadow? The Huns. Now, it would still be a few more years yet before the Romans were battered directly by the Hunnic storm. But the tidal wave of Goths that was about to break on top of Thrace and Moesia, well, that was caused directly by the Hun earthquake that had just hit up in the north. Yeah, that's right. The Huns were both a storm and an earthquake, which should give you some idea as to just how crazy a geopolitical revolution they were about to set off. But in reality, they were neither a storm nor an earthquake. They were simply a fierce nomadic warrior tribe from the central Eurasian steppe with really awesome compound bows. As with the Goths, the origin of the Huns has been lost to time. And as with the Saxons, the exact definition of what makes a Hun at this point in history is kind of difficult to pin down. For years, scholars followed the lead of an 18th century French scholar who believed the Huns were a latter-day incarnation of the Xiongnu, powerful nomads from around Mongolia who battled constantly with the Han Chinese from 200 BC until about 50 AD when they broke apart following a civil war. According to this theory, a portion of the Xiongnu refused to be integrated into the Han Empire and migrated west, eventually becoming the Huns that we know and love today. These days, this theory is treated skeptically, though there is evidence both for and against a link with the Xiongnu. The more modern theory is that the Huns were simply a conglomeration of a few different nomadic groups who had been pushed west in the 300s AD by the rise of yet another powerful nomadic conglomeration known as the Rouran, who in the early 400s would become the first group to identify their leader with the now world-famous honorific Khan. As they moved west, the Huns, whoever they were, followed the simple nomadic warrior life. Extract tribute from any settled group you encounter to help offset the rather meager wealth generated by your herd and trade-based economy. As the Huns proved to be highly effective warriors, they had no trouble dominating any and all nations they encountered as they slowly drifted west. As with the Mongols, who would prove to be their military and spiritual heirs, Hun warriors were primarily horse-mounted archers, who used a particularly sturdy compound bow to blast out of the water and then completely overrun any army they faced. According to Peter Heather, the key technical difference between the Hun compound bow and earlier compound bows is that an asymmetric design allowed the Hun bow to be larger and thus generate more force. Taller at the top than at the bottom, this longer Hun bow could be used effectively on horseback without constantly bumping into the horse itself. This small alteration allowed the bow to generate more power and thus penetrate armor from a greater distance, switching the military balance of power north of the Danube away from slow-moving, spear-wielding heavy cavalry back to faster, bow and arrow-wielding light cavalry. Around 370, the Huns and their golden bow arrived at the coast of the Black Sea and began knocking over dominoes. The first to fall were the Alans, who, after being defeated, joined in the Hunnic Confederation because, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. In 375, probably right around the time Valentinian was arriving in Illyria, the Huns made first contact with the Goths. The first Goths that the Huns made contact with were the branch known as the Gruthungi, if I am at all pronouncing that correctly, who lived further away from the Roman frontier, east of the Dniester River. After blowing through the Gruthungi, the Huns would then face the Taravingi branch of the Goths, who lived nearer the Roman border. For those keeping score at home, Othanaric and Fritigern, who we met last time, were both chieftains of the Taravingi branch. In time, after all the chaos that is about to ensue washes out, these two branches will reorganize themselves into what we today call the Visigoths and the Ostrogoths. The names can be confusing, but literally all Visigoth and Ostrogoth means is Western Goth and Eastern Goth, with the Dniester River serving as a rough dividing line between the two. Of course, just to confuse things a little bit more, I should note that the Visigoth-Ostrogoth distinction was mostly a later literary convention that was not necessarily recognized by the Goths themselves at the time. When the Grithungi refugees streamed into Tervingi territory, Othanaric, still the most powerful king in the region, knew it would only be a matter of time before his people, too, faced this Hun army. Looking to seize the initiative, Othanaric sent out an army across the Dniester to engage the Huns before they crossed the river and hopefully compel these invaders to stop short. But the Huns noticed the approaching Gothic army and simply did an end run around them, crossing the Dniester unopposed. Othanaric recognized that he wouldn't be able to stand against the Huns for long, so he did what he had done when Valens came looking for him and fled up into the Carpathian Mountains. But his failure to stop the invaders had undermined his authority, and only a small portion of Othanaric's people followed him up into the mountains to continue the resistance. The rest either stayed put and resigned themselves to vassalhood, or chose to follow Fritigern, who seized on Othanaric's political stumble as an opportunity to take control of the Western Goths. He believed the wisest course of action would be to flee south and hide behind the protective wall of the Roman legions. And so it was that in the spring of 376, a great unwashed mass of Gothic refugees, Grithungi and Tervingi alike, stood on the north bank of the Danube River, desperately hoping to be allowed admission into the empire before they were crushed by the Huns. A mixed Gothic embassy then traveled to Antioch to beg for mercy before the emperor himself. Now at this point, I would like to stop and remind everyone of something. In shorthand accounts of the later Roman Empire, it is common for the story to go, Valens made a huge mistake, letting this massive horde of Goths into Roman territory, and, you know, what did he think was going to happen? Adrianople was thus the direct result of that fundamental blunder. However, this shorthand version implies that admission of barbarians into the empire was somehow unprecedented, that the soon-to-break-out Gothic War is what would inevitably happen if you were ever so stupid as to allow a big group of barbarians into the empire like that. But as we all know by now, the settlement of barbarians within Roman territory was totally precedented. It had been an occasionally used expedient going all the way back to the reign of Tiberius, and for the last century, it had been a fundamental pillar of imperial border policy. When we look to assign blame, then, for what's about to happen, we need to look at how the admission of the Goths was managed, rather than the fact that it happened at all. The main thing to keep in mind is that there was a way this sort of thing was done. In general, there were two types of barbarian groups settling in the empire: those that had been beaten in battle, and those who were applying for admission because they thought it might offer them a better life. In either case, entrance was predicated on a few rules. First, the barbarians were to be disarmed. Second, they were to be dispersed into smaller settlements, rather than be allowed to stay as one mass group. Third, they were to recognize Roman authority and abandon official allegiance to their old kings. Fourth, when members of these settled tribes were inevitably drafted into the Roman army, they were to fight with Roman-supplied weapons and fight under Roman officers. All of these rules aimed at the same goal: gaining economic and military strength from the influx of new bodies, while breaking the existing tribal power structure. Finally, there was one really big, never-to-be-forgotten rule. When the barbarians first cross over into Roman territory, they must be met by an overwhelming display of force. Initial relocation must be overseen by a numerically superior legionary force, otherwise you risk the whole thing blowing up in your face. When the Goths crossed over the Danube in 376, exactly none of these rules were followed. And so, the whole thing blew up in the Romans' face. The last thing to note is that when we consider Valens' response to the Gothic ambassadors, it does appear that he was well aware of these basic rules of settlement. The emperor knew that between his gearing up for war against Persia, his lending of some troops to Valentinian to fight the Alemanni, and a minor revolt that had broken out in Cilicia, that the Danube frontier was undermanned and ill-equipped to handle a massive influx of Goths, which is why he never granted permission for anything like the mass migration that wound up breaking out. The plan was probably to allow a limited number of Goths in, make their admission contingent upon providing conscripts for the Roman army, and then deal with the rest, granting admission or not on a case-by-case basis from a much stronger military position. The later admitted Goths would then be forced to provide conscripts for the Roman army as well, who could then be transferred to the Eastern Front to help fight the Persians. All in all, it was shaping up to be a pretty decent deal for everyone. The question then was, which Goths do we let in first? The answer to that question was easy. Fritigern had provided assistance to Valens during the campaign against Othanaric a few years before, making the Gothic leader a favorite of the emperor's. On top of that, Fritigern and his followers appear to have recently converted to Valens' preferred Arian form of Christianity. Combined, these two facts led to Valens' official ruling. Fritigern's Tervingi would be allowed in, while the rest of the Goths, particularly the Gruthungi, must stay on the north bank of the Danube. When the embassy returned with the emperor's decision, there was panic among the still-to-be-barred Goths. The Huns could be coming over the hill any minute. If we stay here, we're dead. Fritigern's people, on the other hand, were overjoyed at the news and immediately began to cross over the river under the watchful eye of the Roman authorities. And then things started to get out of hand. If you've ever been to a free concert in the park that's reached capacity, you may know what's coming next. The flimsy fences and volunteer security forces don't stand a chance against the hordes of fans being denied access to their favorite band. The denied Goths jealously watched their anointed cousins joyfully crossing the river and figured, well, hell, there's more of us than there are Roman guards, and if we stay here, we're just going to die anyway, so let's join the migration and dare the Romans to do something about it. Of course, the Romans couldn't do anything about it, and pretty soon what had briefly been a controlled trickle was now an uncontrolled flood. The Roman soldiers pulled back and formed a defensive perimeter to contain the damage, but there was no stopping the Goths now. They were coming in, all of them. Once the Goths were all across, the situation quickly deteriorated as the overmatched Roman forces were unable to impose any of the standard rules of settlement. The Goths were not disarmed. They were not forced to submit to Roman authority. They were not broken up into smaller groups. They were just a big horde of armed barbarians who still recognized their own leaders and who were still mighty distrustful of the Romans. Seeing as how the Romans had made it very clear that most of the Goths currently sitting on the south bank of the Danube had not at all been welcome in the first place. So what we have here is a big pile of, like, leaves, cardboard boxes, and dried sticks. There's nothing that says this pile has to erupt into a bonfire, but it's a pretty dangerous combination that ought to be treated accordingly. Instead of caution, however, the local Roman authorities, particularly a commander named Lupicinus, poured gasoline all over the pile, and then started chucking lit firecrackers at it. The big problem was that instead of trying to figure out how to manage this incredibly volatile situation, Lupicinus and his officers spent their time figuring out how to exploit it. One of the things they quickly figured out was that the Goths were seriously undersupplied, which meant that there were many, many mouths to feed and not nearly enough food to feed them all. Contained for now in what amounted to a massive refugee camp, the Goths were forced to rely on Roman provisions to survive. And from the top down, the Roman authorities began to prey on Gothic hunger. Price gouging on food became common, and once the Goths ran out of valuables to trade, the Romans magnanimously allowed them to sell their children into slavery in exchange for bags of moldy grain. Now, the Goths were a desperate people, but they were still a proud people, and rage over the daily humiliations they were being forced to endure began to swell. Agitation began to grow, anger began to rise, and violence began to look like a fairly reasonable response. Ready, willing, and able to make a bad situation worse, Lupicinus responded to the increasing Gothic frustration by inviting their leaders to a banquet to talk over the problems at his regional headquarters in Marcianopolis. It won't come as a surprise when you hear that in the middle of this banquet, most of the chiefs were arrested, with some being held hostage to blackmail the rest of the Goths into submission, while the rest were summarily executed. When the Goths found out what had happened to their leaders, they exploded. They stormed out of their camps and massed at the gate of Marcianopolis, demanding justice. And by justice, I mean Lupicinus's head. Fritigern, who was one of the Gothic leaders now being held prisoner, saw an opportunity to escape bondage by telling Lupicinus that the only way things were going to calm down is if Fritigern himself was allowed to go out to meet his people. Lupicinus agreed to this plan, counting on Fritigern's typically pro-Roman worldview to see disaster averted. But it appears that after all the lies, all the exploitation, and now the surprise arrest, that Lupicinus had made an enemy out of a friend. Fritigern did hold up his end of the bargain, in that he quelled the immediate unrest outside of Marcianopolis, but only because he told his people that they didn't have the means to besiege the city, so it would be pointless to even try. Did that mean that they should go back to selling their children into slavery in the refugee camp? Of course not. Fritigern simply directed them towards a far more attainable goal, overpowering the local Roman garrison and then ravaging the living hell out of Thrace. Next week, and I promise this time it will be next week, all chickens will come home to roost. The Danube legions, completely outnumbered, will break in the face of the Gothic army, leaving the barbarian horde free to run amok in the Middle Empire for 2 full years before an adequate response could be mustered. But, as we will also see next week, that adequate response turned out to be not adequate at all, and wind up leaving the Emperor Valens and 2/3 of his Eastern Roman army dead in the field. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome, episode 153, Adrianople. In early 377 AD, after months of deprivation, frustration, and humiliation, the Goths finally snapped. They had begged for entry into the Roman Empire because they thought they might find refuge there. Instead, they had been unforgivably mistreated by the local authorities. What was the point of fleeing from the Huns, who, and I can't believe I messed this up, used composite bows, not compound bows, because compound bows weren't invented until like the 1960s, and God help us all if the Huns had ever gotten a hold of compound bows. Anyway, what was the point of fleeing from the Huns if the Romans were going to prove just as menacing a threat? Was this a case of out of the frying pan and into the fire? Not exactly. More a case of out of the frying pan and onto the ground next to the fire. Still in danger, but not quite so immediately, especially given the military situation on the Danube frontier. The Goths may have been weak from a year of flight and harassment, but as we saw last time, the Romans were not exactly in tip-top shape themselves. They were outnumbered locally and run by a commander whose judgment has to be seriously questioned. You'll recall from last week that following Lupicinus' botched attempt to blackmail the Goths into submission by taking their leaders hostage, the Tervingii leader Fritigern promised to go to his people and calm them down. Instead, as much snapped as his fellow Goths, Fritigern stirred them to war. The morning after the fatal banquet, Lupicinus led a Roman army out of Marcianopolis toward the Gothic camp, where he hoped to put down their rabble-rousing once and for all. But Fritigern and the Goths were now eager for a fight, and when Lupicinus arrived, he was hit full in the face by a bunch of really ticked-off Gothic warriors. Like most of the engagements we'll run through over the next couple of years, the battle that ensued is not well described, but it appears that Lupicinus' army was overwhelmed, broken, and put to flight. Once the Goths were ready to move on, there was literally no one around to stop them. The immediate vicinity had been defended only by the Roman forces the Goths had just broken. What garrisons remained on the frontier line were spread out and isolated. Attempting to do something about the Goths without reinforcements would have been suicide, so these garrisons simply sat tight behind their walls and waited. The word immediately went out to east and west that the Goths were loose in the central part of the empire. In the east, Valens had to have greeted this news with a profanity-laced tirade. I know that I would have anyway. The emperor was gearing up for a major war against the Sassanids, and the last time he had checked, the Goths were supposed to be supplying troops for that major war. Now they've gone berserk, smashed the local Roman army, and are running amok in Thrace? What the hell happened? As had been the case with Constantine II twice during his reign, Valens was left with a problem that could only be solved by moving in a major force to contain the damage right at the moment when he absolutely could not pull troops off the Syrian frontier. Hell and damnation. In the west, the young emperor Gratian received word of the Gothic revolt and immediately wanted to do something to help. But in his rush to be helpful, he got a bit carried away. Pretty soon, orders were flying around to the effect that the whole of the Rhine legions were to pack up at once and march east. But proving that General Maributus, the one who had elevated Valentinian II, still had absolutely no confidence in Gratian's military judgment, and that Gratian's power at this point was not at all absolute, the Roman high command rewrote the orders in transit. A major force from the Rhine could and should be detached to go fight the Goths, but to leave the Rhine unprotected, no matter how calm it had been the last few years, would have been dereliction of duty. As we will soon see, the decision to leave the Rhine well defended would come back to do whatever the opposite of haunt the Romans is. The Western Expeditionary Force that was sent was led by a general named Ricimer, who, so far as I can tell, is in no way related to the more famous Ricimer we'll deal with a bit down the road. The movement of the Goths is no certain thing during 377, so we don't know exactly how the year went blow by blow. But after running off Lupicinus, the Goths appear to have barreled south toward Adrianople, pillaging away to their heart's content. After the humiliations of the previous year, first being chased off their land by the Huns, then being exploited by the Romans, you can bet that they had some rage to burn off, and mercy was not presently in their vocabulary. Ricimer and his troops appear to have met up with an expeditionary force peeled off by Valens and sent in from the west. Wary of an open confrontation, Fritigern responded to the news of the arrival of the new Roman forces by leading his people back north. Ricimer followed until the Goths were once again contained to the lands near the border, whereupon the Roman commanders decided to make a play at ending the conflict right then and there. They attacked the Gothic position, but were unable to break the barbarians, and the Battle of Ad Salices turned out to be nothing but a bloody draw. It looked like a permanent solution to the Gothic problem was only going to come with the arrival of Valens, a fact that the Eastern Augustus was well aware of. In the wake of the news that the Goths were loose, Valens, again like Constantine II, rushed an embassy off to Shapur to work out a peace treaty with the Persians that would free up his men to march west. It took some time to get the terms worked out, and Valens had to agree to a treaty that was not at all favorable to Rome. But in the winter of 378, the two empires were once again technically at peace. Valens then assigned a skeleton crew to man the eastern frontier and turned the rest of his army west. But Valens knew instinctively that his own army might not be enough to overwhelm the Goths, and so he kept in communication with Gratian, constantly demanding more firepower from his younger colleague to help guarantee victory on the Danube. Gratian, as we've already seen, did not need much convincing, and when Valens announced that he was finally heading west, Gratian gathered up a mobile field army of his own and marched them into Illyria. By all accounts, then, it looked like the Goths were about to be hit hard from both sides, and that the Gothic War would go down in history as just another temporary barbarian raid, rather than a full-scale war. But all the troop movement along the Rhine had caught the attention of the Alemanni, and they decided to take the opportunity to launch a raid of their own. The troops Maributus had refused to redeploy did an excellent job slowing the progress of the Alemanni, but getting them back on the other side of the Rhine was going to take a more concerted effort. Gratian was forced to march his men back out of Illyria to deal with the crisis, writing to Valens that as soon as the Rhine was resecured, he would be back, and that it shouldn't take more than a couple of months. This is normally where you'd expect to hear that, of course, it didn't take months for Gratian to push back the Alemanni. It took years, which left Valens to face the Goths alone. But the thing is, it did only take a few months. By the middle of summer 378, Gratian was back in Sirmium with his army, ready, willing, and able to help crush the Goths. So the question is, why did Valens go off and face them alone? Which is what he's about to do? It's a good question. A very good question. The frosty reception the emperor received from the people of Constantinople when he arrived there in May of 378 probably forms the beginning of the answer to that question. Valens had never been popular in the capital, as evidenced by the ease with which Procopius had been able to take control of the city 10 years before, and Valens was now entering the capital a year and a half after the Goths had broken free of all restraints. Where, the people of Constantinople wondered, have you been? Valens was made acutely aware of the fact that the citizens of the city were not at all impressed by his handling of the situation thus far. They wanted no more delays. They wanted action. They wanted Valens to go out and do something about the Goths, and more than that, they wanted victory. Serious leaders like to pretend that public opinion plays no role when serious men are making these serious decisions of state, but the fact is that it does. Always has, and always will. Compounding Valens's public relations problem was the news from the Western Front that Gratian had just won a decisive victory against the Alemanni. So now people were not just asking why Valens hadn't acted yet. They were asking why they were stuck with Valens at all. If only Gratian were here, this whole mess would be cleaned up by now. By the time Valens left Constantinople a few weeks later, this was all rattling around inside of his head. And at this point, the emperor looks an awful lot like a man with something to prove. And as we all know, men with something to prove often blunder off recklessly and wind up making a huge mess of things. The other dynamic at work is that Valens was lulled into a false sense of security. In June or July, an advance guard of 2,000 Romans moving west encountered a unit of Goths and defeated them easily in a quick skirmish. News of the victory spurred the notion that the Goths were eminently beatable. They just needed to be hit the right way. Plus, as this was yet another victory that Valens himself was not present for, the skirmish likely also snowballed the emperor's own sense that he needed to get in on the action to prove that he too was a great military leader. In late July or early August, Roman scouts reported that a force of around 10,000 Goths was moving south toward Adrianople. Though we sadly don't have reliable troop numbers for the Roman army, the assumption is that Valens's force was somewhere between 20 and 30,000 strong, giving the emperor a 2 or 3 to 1 advantage. Why hesitate with an advantage like that? Valens advanced to Adrianople and occupied the city. At this point, it appears that Ricimer joined the emperor at Adrianople to advise Valens on his next move. The Western general was emphatic that Valens ought to wait for Gratian's reinforcement. They were already in Illyria. The only question was how quickly could they link up with Valens to help deliver the final blow. Half of Valens' staff concurred with this opinion. With the combined power of East and West, victory was practically guaranteed, so why risk defeat? But Valens was more inclined to listen to the hawks on his staff. They reminded the emperor that he already had a massive numerical advantage, that he was operating out of a heavily fortified position, and that further delay just left time for the Goths to gather more men. Hit them now before they are reinforced, and it'll be a walk in the park. Plus, do we really need to remind you that if you wait for Gratian, that you'll be living with the fact that you had to be bailed out by your teenage nephew for the rest of your life? Good luck with your reputation. Valens' decision became apparent after Fritigern sent envoys about a peace deal. The emperor dismissed them without even offering terms. So there it was. Valens was suffering from a PR problem, did not want to share the glory of victory with Gratian, and believed that he had a sizable numerical advantage over the approaching Goths. Except there was a huge, large, gigantic flaw in his rationale for forcing battle. It was not 10,000 Goths approaching, it was more like 15 or 20,000. The scouts had reported only on Fritigern's Tervingii infantry, which was indeed 10,000 strong. What they had missed was the Gruthungi cavalry, who were scattered across the countryside foraging for supplies. Add them together, and Valens was planning on marching off to face an enemy that could possibly match him man for man. And even if he did enjoy a slight numerical advantage, that was not going to make up for the totally surprising come-out-of-nowhere appearance of the Gruthungi cavalry in the middle of the battle. Nothing drops your heart faster than the sudden appearance of unaccounted-for enemy troops. Am I right, fellas? On the morning of August 9, Valens led his army out of Adrianople, leaving behind only the imperial treasury and a small company of soldiers to guard the city walls. The rest he marched northwest toward the Goths. And what a march it turned out to be. Though we call what is about to ensue the Battle of Adrianople, the Romans marched for a good 7 or 8 hours before they finally made contact with the enemy, which did not exactly get the Romans off on the right foot. Instead of meeting the Goths rested and ready, the Romans met them tired and panting in the afternoon heat. But whatever. These were highly trained soldiers used to that kind of physical exertion. It shouldn't be too big of a deal that our guys are exhausted and their guys are fresh. Right? Fritigern had deployed his men in a compact mass protecting their wagon train, which was drawn up on a low hill. At this point, the Romans really did have a numerical advantage, so Fritigern's main objective was to stall for as long as possible until the Gruthungi cavalry could be rounded up. He and his men lit fires to create a huge smoke screen to confuse the situation, and then repeatedly asked to negotiate a peace. But Valens refused all entreaties, convinced that Fritigern was stalling to allow time for potential reinforcements to arrive, which is, of course, exactly what the Gothic king was doing. But though he was eager for battle, that did not mean that Valens ever actually gave the order to charge. In one of those funny little twists of fate, the Battle of Adrianople got going not because the opposing generals were ready for it to, but rather because an overzealous allied king on the Roman right flank advanced without orders. Before anyone could pull him back, the Battle of Adrianople was on. At first, the surprising commencement of hostilities worked out just fine for the Romans. The eager beaver allied king on the right was pushed back, but the Roman left surged forward, and before too long had pressed the Goths all the way back to their wagons. Capturing the baggage train meant taking the women and the children and all of the Gothic possessions. Another half an hour, maybe, and the Romans would have won Adrianople outright, accidental start or no accidental start. But then the cavalry arrived. Literally, the cavalry arrived. The Girthungi horsemen, who had not at all been taken into account when the Romans were making their war plans, suddenly exploded onto the scene and broadsided the Roman left, blowing right through the Roman cavalry, which was supposed to be guarding the wing. Now the Roman left, which had been so close to winning the battle the minute before, was now pushed back and became trapped between the Tervingi infantry, the Girthungi cavalry, and the hill that the Goths had positioned their wagons on. Crammed together, the Roman soldiers were too close to one another to maneuver, retreat, or even fight for their lives. And so, they started to be slaughtered. From the moment the Gothic cavalry arrived, the Battle of Adrianople was over. The Romans wound up leaving fully two-thirds of their army dead in the field, with only isolated pockets of soldiers escaping the carnage. Valens himself was lost in the fighting. No one knows exactly what happened to the emperor, but a later story has him being taken to a nearby farmhouse after being wounded and then dying when the Goths set fire to the building. But no contemporary account mentions this incident. In all likelihood, he simply fell anonymously in the thick of the fray and was never heard from again, becoming the second emperor in Roman history to die in battle, following the ignoble example set by Decius at Abritus 125 years before. Valens was 50 years old and had ruled the eastern half of the empire for 14 years. It is difficult to overstate the significance of the Battle of Adrianople. Though you cannot trace the fall of the Western Empire back to any single event, more people have tried to trace it back to Adrianople than just about anywhere else. I should mention, though, that there is one area that the significance of Adrianople is often overstated. For years, military historians repeated a line about how the decisive role played by the Gothic cavalry in the battle changed the nature of armed conflict in the West. In this telling, Adrianople serves as the dividing line between the infantry battles of antiquity and the heavy cavalry battles of the medieval period. That is, that once everyone saw how effective the horsemen could be, they dropped their old infantry model and picked up a shiny new cavalry model. Except, as we all know, the Romans and everyone else were already well aware of how effective cavalry was by the time of Adrianople, and had long ago adopted a more horse-reliant model for their armed forces. How long ago did I introduce Gallienus' mobile cavalry force? Something like 40 episodes back, right? To say that the world woke up on the morning after Adrianople and said, "My God, cavalry is now the thing," is to just ignore a whole century's worth of history. It's a minor point, but since it's a point often wrapped up in accounts of the battle, I figured I'd just go ahead and join in the debunking of it. Now, as to the bits about the battle that can't be overstated, the sheer obliteration of Valens' army definitely rocked the balance of power in the Mediterranean and led to a total recalibration of Roman priorities. Though the Roman Empire was still the biggest kid on the block, they were fast becoming just another kid on the block, if that makes any sense. The Goths and the Huns, and pretty soon the Vandals and the Franks, were all about to prove that they were more than a match for the Roman armies they faced. This had happened once before, in the middle of the 3rd century, and the empire had almost cracked up as a result. Only after a huge effort, a complete military and political reorganization, and a healthy dose of luck, did an intact Roman Empire manage to limp into the 4th century. This time, however, they would not be so lucky, as this time only half the empire would live to fight another day. And that was just the long-term impact of the battle. The short-term impact of the battle was almost too nightmarish to contemplate. The emperor was dead, his army destroyed. The eastern frontier was now manned by just a skeleton crew. The middle frontier was manned by no one at all. A Gothic army was loose inside the empire that was now not just unchecked, but unbeatable. North of the Danube, the Huns were only picking up steam, and who knew when they were going to attack the empire directly. And to top it all off, at this darkest of dark hours, Rome was ruled by a 19-year-old boy who had no inclination towards soldiering, and a 7-year-old boy who was, well, a 7-year-old boy. Many historians find only the days after Cannae to be remotely comparable in terms of the sheer mind-blowing disasterness of it all. What were the Romans going to do now? Next week, we will find out what the Romans are going to do now. Without a capable heir ready to step in and rule the East, Gratian will be forced to look outside of the family and turn to the son of the man that his father Valentinian had turned to time and time again to mop up the worst messes in the empire. Stuck in a forced retirement in Spain, Theodosius the Younger will answer Gratian's call, somehow manage to steer the East away from utter destruction, and in the end, become the last man to serve as the sole and undisputed master of the Roman Empire. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 154, The Gothic War. There's an old legend that a few days after the Battle of Adrianople, Fritigern and his triumphant Goths advanced on Constantinople. Fear and trepidation seized the capital at the sight of this great horde advancing, because the people of the city knew there would be no stopping them. The emperor was dead, and his army destroyed. It seemed that only God himself could deliver them all from doom. But of course, as it turned out, it did not take God to deliver Constantinople from doom. All it took was the Goths getting one look at the city walls. Fritigern's horde may have been the largest army for 500 miles in any direction, but that did not mean they had the skills or the tools to lay siege to a fortified city. There would be no sacking of Constantinople. Instead, the Goths turned around and headed back into the heart of the Balkans, looking for prizes they actually had the means to win. No one knows if this little anecdote is true in fact, but it is at least true in spirit, as it captures the essence of the stalemate that is about to ensue between the Romans and the Goths, a stalemate referred to, perhaps a bit grandiosely, as the Gothic War. Way back during the episodes on Aurelian, I spent some time detailing how the Romans had changed their military posture in the face of the crisis of the 3rd century to reflect the new realities of the world. You'll recall that the Romans allowed their static frontier lines to become more permeable, but made up for this by strengthening the defenses of the individual cities dramatically. We've seen in bits and pieces how this worked to the Roman advantage during the various barbarian raids of the last century, but nowhere is the success of the strategy more on display than during the Gothic War. between Pannonia and, God, like Syria, there was literally no Roman army big enough to do a thing about the Goths. And yet, for the next 4 years, Fritigern and his people were unable to do anything more than just sort of roam the countryside. The existence of the Roman Empire was never truly threatened by the Goths, because the fortifications of the various cities were simply too great an obstacle for the barbarians to overcome. So, like I said, the Gothic War played out as a stalemate. The flip side to the Gothic inability to capture fortified cities, though, was the Roman inability to defeat the Goths in open battle. Obviously, in the immediate aftermath of Adrianople, the Romans were unable to confront the Goths in the field. But even after a few years had passed and a new army had been raised, the inexperience, rushed training, and poor morale of the new army left it far inferior to the veteran Gothic warriors. So both sides struggled on, scraping up supplies as best they could, until everyone realized that some kind of settlement needed to be reached. And as we will see, it will be the essence of that settlement, rather than the immediate consequences of military defeat, that tends to elevate Adrianople to its key place in the history of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. The Western Emperor Gratian had already left Sirmium in August 378 and was on his way toward Thrace when news of Adrianople broke. Leading an army that was supposed to be overwhelming only after it linked up with Valens, when Gratian learned that there was no longer a Valens to link up with, he immediately turned his force around. Back in the safety of Sirmium, Gratian and his advisor sat down to survey the damage and see if they couldn't figure out what to do next. The problem they grappled with was twofold, one part military and one part political. The military problem was obvious. An enemy army was loose in Roman territory, and there was no longer a Roman army around to fight it. That needed to be rectified immediately. But Valens had already siphoned off all the men and resources the far eastern frontier could bear to lose. Siphon off any more, and you may as well cede the whole region to Shapur and the Sassanids. Gratian, meanwhile, had redeployed a good chunk of his own Rhine defenses, but that redeployment had already sparked at least one Alemanni invasion. Redeploy any more, and he risked throwing the whole west into chaos. As much as Gratian and his war council hated to admit it, the Central Empire was more or less on its own. The Eastern and Western legions could provide leaders and some support staff, but other than that, the Middle Empire was going to have to raise a whole new army by itself, which is not exactly what they wanted to hear, I'm sure. And as if the military problem wasn't bad enough on its own, Gratian also had to deal with the political problem, namely, that with Valens dead, there was now a massive power vacuum in the east. Under normal circumstances, going with just one emperor was a dicey proposition, and I'm not really counting Valentinian II in all of this, since no one else seems to be either. But given the absolutely dire circumstances facing Rome, going with just one emperor would have been insane. So, it was time to play everyone's favorite game, let's pick a new emperor. And remember, if you accidentally back the wrong man or speak out against the man who ultimately does win the prize, then your career will most likely be over, and you may even wind up dead. So good luck, everyone. Let's play the game. But even though the need to fill the power vacuum was acutely felt by everyone, when they finally did land on a candidate they could agree on, they did not just elevate him to the purple right away. Instead, they gave him military jurisdiction over the shattered Balkan provinces to see how he would handle the crisis. Only after passing this initial test would the candidate be elevated to the purple, which he was, but not until almost 6 months after Valens disappeared at Adrianople. So what is the name of this future emperor? Why, Theodosius, of course. Now, at the end of episode 150, I hinted at the fate of Valentinian's Mr. Fix-It, Theodosius the Elder. But in the confusing rush of events that followed Valentinian I's death, I neglected to follow up on that hint. So, I will do so now. You would think a resume as sterling as the elder Theodosius's would have given him a measure of protection in the post-Valentinian realignment. But alas, men that capable often make enemies as easily as they solve problems, and Theodosius was no exception. The clique of high officials who came to power immediately after Valentinian's death was no fan of the elder Theodosius. We don't know why he was disliked, but historians have speculated that the execution for treason of a particular general who was close to the clique by Mr. Fix-It while he was serving in Britain was a potential catalyst for Theodosius's ultimate demise. Sadly, though, not only do we not know what the exact charges were that brought him down, we don't even know who authored the charges. That is, whether they sprang from the court of Gratian or the court of Valentinian II. Whatever the charges were, though, and wherever they came from, Theodosius the Elder was executed in 375 while he was still in North Africa attempting to sort out the mess created by Romanus. The fate of Theodosius's nearly 30-year-old son during the next few years is equally difficult to nail down. What we know for sure is that Theodosius the Younger was serving as a commander in Moesia around the time of Valentinian's death, and then later he was living in Spain, and then later still we find him back in charge of troops in Thrace. But the timeline is garbled. The most commonly told version of the story, though, is that the younger Theodosius was caught up in the intrigues that brought down his father, and he was driven out of public service. He then retired to his home in Spain, where he married, started a family, and likely expected to pass the rest of his days living the comfortable life of a country aristocrat. But then the wheel of destiny rolled over on the plains near Adrianople, and Gratian recalled Theodosius the Younger from retirement and ordered him to take charge of the shattered legions of the Middle Empire. This version of the story relies on conjecture that there had been a turnover in the upper rungs of Gratian's court that brought to power a group of officials who had been friends of the elder Theodosius and knew the abilities of his son. It also relies on conjecture that all the high-ranking military officials in the East who had survived Adrianople were all now discredited by the defeat, and that the emperor was looking for a man untainted by the recent debacle to come in and salvage the situation. There is another, less repeated version of the story that has Theodosius initially sacked, not by a malicious clique targeting his family, but by Valentinian himself. Why? Well, because Theodosius was being held responsible for the failure of one of his legions during the Quadi raid that had followed the diplomatic plunder of Marcellianus. This version goes on to report that Theodosius was almost immediately reinstated to the army following the ascension of Gratian. So in this telling, Theodosius was actually serving in Illyria at the time of Adrianople, and the reason he was chosen to go salvage the situation in Thrace and Moesia was that he was the nearest commander of noble Roman birth available to Gratian at that moment. So his elevation to power was more a coincidence of proximity than anything else. To be honest, I have only ever heard the version that Theodosius was in Spain, and didn't know there was even an alternate until I started doing research for these episodes, but Dr. David Woods of the University College of Cork thinks that we've been misreading unreliable sources for years, so I thought I'd throw it out there. Whichever way it happened, after Adrianople, Gratian and his advisors decided that the now 32-year-old Theodosius was the man for them. As I just mentioned, though, the initial promotion did not come with purple robes. Instead, Theodosius was simply given overall military command of Moesia and Thrace, the two provinces presently qualified as national disaster areas. His mandate? Oh my God, try to restore some order. Theodosius spent the next 6 months getting a handle on the situation trying to reorganize what was left of Valens's army, and ensuring that the various cities of the region could hold out without relief for a little while. Because, be aware, no relief will be coming for a little while. He acquitted himself well enough during this trial period that the further promotion, the one that really had been his to lose, was now offered. On January 19, 379 AD, in a ceremony at Sirmium, Theodosius was elevated to the rank of Augustus. He was given command over all of Valens's territories, with one notable addition. The western diocese of Illyria, which had traditionally been controlled by the western Augustus, as they protected the passes into Italy, were ceded over to Theodosius in order to create a unified theater of operations. Though he was now emperor of the whole of the Eastern Empire, Theodosius's new mandate was crystal clear. Defeat the Goths. But that was, of course, easier said than done. As we've seen, reinforcements could not just be called in from elsewhere. The empire was stretched as thin as it was going to stretch. So Theodosius had to spend the next year raising and training a whole new army. At this point in history, there were three sources of new soldiers for Theodosius to draw on, and he drew from all of them to help fill his ranks. First, there were retired veterans, whose discharge contracts required them to return to service should the emperor deem it necessary. Second, there were raw draftees, yanked from civilian life. And third, there were barbarian fighters not aligned with the barbarian fighters the empire was currently fighting. The first needed only be notified that they were being recalled. The second needed only be drafted. And the third needed only be paid. As Theodosius found out, though, the first and third sources of troops were fairly easy to manage. But that second source turned out to be a sticking point. Many people have asked why an empire as large as the Roman Empire ever had trouble with military recruitment, especially since they were able to replace their armies practically overnight when they were just a regional Italian power. A big part of the problem is something that Theodosius is about to find out. Very few people these days are crazy enough to want to join the army. Life in the army of late antiquity was harsh, uncomfortable, dangerous, and just swarming with draconian punishments of every shape and size. Only the phony tough or the crazy brave willingly signed up for a life that promised little more than a choice between death by disease, death by sword, or death by a senior officer who had woken up on the wrong side of the cot. Part of the reason Diocletian instituted the laws that forced men to inherit their father's profession was to keep the ranks of the army reasonably well stocked. Otherwise, the frontiers would have wound up unmanned two generations back. But compounding the problem of soldiering being a really unattractive profession was the attitude of rich landowners. Though their enlightened self-interest should have led them to support military recruitment, after all, being rich doesn't count for much when your empire is undefended, but unfortunately, the immediate self-interest of the landowners usually led them to do everything in their power to hinder military recruitment. The manpower shortage that afflicted the army was just an extension of the more general manpower shortage that was afflicting the whole empire, and every poor sod who joined the army was one less poor sod available to work the enormous estates of the landowners. So what wound up happening is that when the draft officials came around demanding a landowner provide his quota of poor sods, the landowner would lie about how many poor sods he had. When pressed, the landowner might hand over the oldest, lamest, and feeblest of his workers, but the best of the bunch would usually be hidden away from view. This willful obstruction of military recruitment during a national security crisis enraged the emperors, and a series of laws threatening horrible punishment to anyone who held able-bodied men back flew out of the imperial courts, usually to no avail. It was also well known to soldiers already in service that if they decided to desert, and they managed to make it to a large estate, that the owner would often secretly shelter them in exchange for a pledge of servitude. This was also well known to the emperors, and so another series of laws came flying out of the imperial courts prohibiting the practice. Again, usually to no avail. This tension between the economic interests of large landowners and the military interests of the state was, you guessed it, another one of the 257 different reasons why the Western Empire is nearing collapse. When Theodosius finally gathered up an army large enough to maybe do something about the Goths, he drilled them and trained them and drilled them some more. But despite all the training, Theodosius' army was never going to be more than a ragtag bunch of misfits. The recalled veterans were experienced, but they were old. The new recruits were young, but not at all professional soldiers, and, having been pressed into service, their morale was low and their desertion rate was high. And then there were the auxiliary barbarians, some of whom were ethnically Goth. Who knew where their loyalties lay? Theodosius was smart enough then to do two things. First, for the whole of 379, he never risked putting this army into battle. Not only would a loss have been catastrophic, but given the gulf of ability between the seasoned Goths and the green Romans, a loss was very likely going to be the outcome. This meant that the Goths had a full year during which they basically had the run of the Middle Empire. But still, a Roman loss would have been catastrophic. It simply could not be risked. The other thing Theodosius was smart enough to do was not treat this army like a professional force of willing volunteers. Discipline was tight, but not draconian. Deserters were not killed as long as they came back. Floggings for minor infractions were kept to a minimum. He needed these men to fight for him someday. Beating them mercilessly because they weren't digging that hole right would have been counterproductive. Not that any of this really mattered. It would have made for a heartwarming story had this ragtag bunch gone out and saved the day. But unfortunately for Hollywood executives everywhere, that's not the way it went. When Theodosius finally led his army out into battle in 380, the hope, of course, was that he was leading them out to avenge Adrianople and crush the barbarians. But it was not to be. And this is even after the Goths helped the Romans out by having the Gruthungi and the Tervingi decide to go their separate ways earlier in the year, leaving Theodosius with a much less daunting task ahead of him. Citing the fact that there was not enough food around to feed them all, the Gruthungi decided to head northwest, where they were eventually crushed by a western army guarding the Illyrian frontier. This left Theodosius with only Fritigern and the Tervingi to deal with. But when the two sides met in battle at some unknown point later in 380, the Goths once again won the day. The sources point to some unknown bit of treachery just before the battle, possibly the defection of some of those barbarian auxiliaries, but all other details have been lost to history. However, despite the Roman defeat, Theodosius made sure that it was not another Adrianople, and the new emperor extracted his army from the fray before things got out of hand. From that moment on, Theodosius's strategy for winning the war changed completely. He no longer believed that he could deliver the kind of outright military victory that he was expected to win, and so, he focused all his energy on reaching a peace agreement that would be acceptable to both sides. After 3 years of wandering aimlessly, trying to feed themselves on ever-diminishing spoils of war, Theodosius was betting that the Goths were probably getting as ready for a settlement as he was. In January of 381, the emperor was gifted an opportunity to demonstrate his honorable intentions when Othanaric, the old enemy of Rome who had sworn never to set foot in the empire, arrived at the Danube with what remained of his people, begging for asylum. The old Gothic king was sick and dying, and after years of hiding out in the Carpathian Mountains, hounded by the Huns, he finally decided enough was enough. He wanted to die in peace, and Theodosius jumped at the chance to give him the opportunity. He welcomed Athanaric into Constantinople, which the emperor himself had only set foot in for the first time just 3 months before. And he treated the Gothic king like, well, a king. And when Athanaric died of his illness 2 weeks later, Theodosius gave him a state funeral. The message Theodosius was hoping to send to Fritigern's people was clear. Romans and Goths are much better served when they are friends, not enemies. If you give me a chance, I am prepared to treat you as well as I have just treated Athanaric and his people. To the outlaw Goths still out in the Roman countryside, this was a message they were willing to hear. But it would still be another year and a half before the war officially came to an end. Throughout that end phase, perpetuating the stalemate became Theodosius's sole military objective. Keeping the city supplied, making sure they could continue to hold out, and never risking an open battle. By the autumn of 382, trapped in a cycle of diminishing returns and perpetual insecurity, the Goths were finally ready to deal. The terms agreed to by the Romans and the Goths were, as I said, the true essence of why Adrianople was such a big deal. The agreement wound up being pretty simple. The Goths would put away their swords if the Romans allowed them to settle within the empire. But critically, the rulebook governing how barbarians were to be settled within the empire was thrown out, and a whole new book was written on the spot. The particular details are lost, but the big overarching themes are visible. For example, the Goths were not broken up and scattered into small settlements, but instead allowed to live together in a large group. This, of course, meant that at all times they had to be seen as a potential military threat, but it also meant that they were better able to maintain their own separate Gothic identities. That is not good. On top of that, the Romans agreed to recognize Gothic leaders and bargain with those leaders when they wanted something out of the Goths. So that whole breaking of the tribal power structure thing that had been the foundation of how the Romans handled barbarian resettlement was now tossed out. In its place, that whole tribal power structure was allowed to persist. This is also not good. Although I will mention here that somewhere along the line, Fritigern magically vanishes from the historical record. No one knows if he died in battle or if he was overthrown by his war-weary people, but there is some speculation that his ouster may have been one of the Roman conditions for peace. You know, we'll deal with your leaders, that's fine, but we won't deal with that leader. Perhaps it was a teensy, tiny measure of revenge for Adrianople. Finally, though many of the settled Goths wound up joining the Roman army as individuals, both sides agreed that if the emperor deemed it necessary, he would be allowed to call on the Gothic nation as a whole to come fight for Rome. However, they would not be required to fight under Roman officers. Instead, they would be allowed to fight in their own way under their own leaders. Basically, they would be nothing more than an emergency auxiliary force serving next to the legions, rather than being a group of Roman citizens serving in the legions. All of this boiled down to the same thing. The Goths were not going to become integrated members of the empire. Instead, they were going to continue on as a foreign nation, who just happened to be living on Roman soil. To say that this was a break with precedent is the understatement of the millennium. Romanization of their enemies had been like the overriding goal of Roman foreign policy going back I don't even know how far, maybe forever. That overriding goal was now kaput. Backed up against the wall, bargaining from a weak position, and desperate just to get the Goths to go to bed, Theodosius chose to deal with them not as mighty empire and puny mortal, but as just another flawed and vulnerable nation trying to secure a peace with just another flawed and vulnerable nation. The ripple effect of this choice would be felt for the next century, and yes, proved to be yet another one of the 257 different reasons why the Western Roman Empire fell apart. But the Roman Empire is not done yet, and next week will be a time of much rejoicing. The 5-year-long Gothic Reign of Terror was at an end, and things could finally go back to normal. Theodosius, Gratian, and the rest of the Romans were allowed to bask in the glow of this quasi-victory for almost a whole year, before, on the complete other side of the world, yet another massive threat to the stability of the empire would pop up. This threat would also lead to the death of an emperor, although instead of coming from outside the empire, this one would come from within. So, at least it was a nice change of pace. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome, Episode 155, The New Bishop of Milan. Last time, we left off with the empire ever so temporarily at peace. The Sassanids had made no sudden moves while Theodosius had been occupied with the Goths, and the Germans of the Rhine frontier had been laying low since Gratian had swooped in and bopped the Alemanni in the head right before the Battle of Adrianople. For the briefest of moments, the Roman Empire was free from the burden of armed conflict. But sadly, it was inevitable that somebody, somewhere, was going to be unable to handle the sheer tranquility of it all and snap. And indeed, it took all of about 10 minutes before somebody, somewhere, snapped. That somebody? A senior general named Magnus Maximus, who was the highest-ranking officer on the island of Britain. Seizing the opportunity that quiet frontiers and dissatisfaction with the Western Augustus Gratian provided, Maximus stormed down off Britannia in 383 and lit a big new fire, where just moments before it looked like the coals were about to finally burn themselves out. Such is life. There's not much to go on about why Maximus decided to suddenly revolt in 383. All we have to go on is vague hints that Gratian was not popular with the soldiers, and that the Roman occupation of Britain was in bad shape morale-wise. To take the last part first, it had been a good 15 years since the great barbarian invasion had nearly knocked the Romans off the island for good. If you'll recall, far from busting their humps fighting the barbarians off, disgruntled legionaries had actually joined in the plundering. You'll recall that when he arrived to take hold of the situation, Theodosius the Elder had been forced to rely on some pretty serious clemency to get the wayward troops back in their barracks. In the decade that followed, Britain was calm, but it does not appear that any of the underlying issues that had led all those soldiers to so readily switch their allegiance had been addressed. The bottom line was that serving on the island was an unglamorous gig with almost no opportunities for glory or enrichment. Though, yes, one does wonder if the British soldiers would have preferred getting annihilated at Adrianople. The more immediate motivation for the revolt, though, was a specific dissatisfaction with Gratian. We've already touched on the fact that the now 24-year-old emperor had never been a soldier's soldier, and that his father had intentionally kept him out of the camps as a young man so that the soldiers wouldn't notice just how not a soldier soldier the future emperor was. But now that Gratian was emperor, it was hard not to notice that he really wasn't one of them. I would like to point out, though, that it's not like he was a disaster or anything. He had, after all, delivered an impressive victory over the Alemanni in early 378. So this was not so much a matter of failure undermining his authority, as it was temperament undermining his authority. Gratian, and can you blame him, preferred the luxuries and comforts of civilian life to the rough hardships of military life. From grunt to general, then, the soldiers never really formed a bond with Gratian. And so, when it came time to defend him or overthrow him, well, as we will see, Gratian died alone. The last specific detail we have about why the troops disliked the emperor was the fact that Gratian seemed to favor his elite Alan bodyguard at the expense of everyone else. In a story reminiscent of Constance and his archers, so reminiscent, in fact, that I wonder which, if either, story is actually true, Gratian appears to have grown so enamored with his Alan guards that on top of lavishing them with wealth and honors, he took to acting like them and dressing like them. Now, the troops up in Britain never would have witnessed this firsthand, but disgruntled stories would have been passed around and done their dirty work to undermine Gratian's reputation anyway. I think the real impact of this favoritism, though, was most likely felt as Maximus's army was approaching Paris. The troops nearest Gratian would have seen it all for themselves, and so when it came time to fight or desert, they decided to desert. After all, if the Alan bodyguard is so awesome, well, let them protect the emperor. The other small bit of information we have about Maximus's motivation comes from the general's resume. See, in particular, that under previous work experience, we have him down as serving in North Africa under Theodosius the Elder during the revolt of Firmus, and before that, we have him down as very likely serving on the campaign to resecure Britain after the barbarian invasions of 367-368, also under Theodosius the Elder. In other words, Maximus was a longtime friend, ally, and compatriot of the Theodosian family. His relationship with the younger Theodosius, 15 years his junior, would have gone back to the earliest stages of the now emperor's career, and given the tone of his correspondence with the Eastern Augustus immediately following the demise of Gratian, it is clear that not only did Maximus expect Theodosius to recognize him as the new Augustus of the West, but he expected Theodosius to be happy about it. When weighing the pros and cons of revolt, the fact that an old friend was now emperor of the East had to have been seen by Maximus as a huge, possibly decisive, pro. But before we get into the revolt of Maximus, I want to back up a little bit and introduce a man who is going to be right smack dab in the middle of it all. And not just right smack dab in the middle of the revolt, mind you, though he was right smack dab in the middle of the revolt, but right smack dab in the middle of everything that happens in the last quarter of the 4th century. State, church, diplomacy, war, peace, you name it, there he is. I speak, of course, of the man you just knew was going to pop up eventually, Aurelius Ambrosius, better known to us as St. Ambrose, the Bishop of Milan. Not to get off on too meta of a tangent, but I tend to see history as an interplay between broad socioeconomic factors and the specific actions of key individuals. Sometimes socioeconomic factors take the lead, like, say, the way the potato famine drove Irish migration to North America in the 1840s. Sometimes the two walk in lockstep, like, say, the way the conditions of post-World War I Germany made the rise of fascism possible, but that the specific and malevolent idiosyncrasies of Hitler defined the form that it took. And sometimes it is the key individual who takes the lead and drives the ox cart of history for a while. Ambrose of Milan was a driver. He was a staunch anti-pagan, he was a staunch anti-Arian, and he believed that all men, emperors included, must kneel before God. When he died in 397, his specific beliefs had more or less become the entrenched imperial worldview. Even more importantly than that, had it not been for Ambrose, it is possible that 1,000 years of argument over whether state was superior to church or church was superior to state might never have occurred, because the church's case never would have gotten off the ground. Any other man serving as Bishop of Milan in the late 4th century, and the whole world turns out differently, I think. He was that big of a deal. And even if you don't believe any of that, at a minimum, you can blame him for the fact that we all have to read selected portions of The City of God for the umpteenth time for the test on Friday. And I can't tell you how much I'd like to shake his hand for that. Ambrose was born in the late 330s AD in the imperial capital of Trier, and was the son of a Praetorian prefect. So the future bishop's life is not a rags-to-riches story, so much as it is a riches-to-more-riches story. Given the hereditary laws in place at the time, the fact that his father was such a high-ranking civil servant meant that Ambrose was destined for a career in the imperial bureaucracy. Which leads us to one of the more interesting facts about Ambrose for someone who knows nothing about him. He never was a priest. He had no intention of ever becoming a priest, and when he was elected Bishop of Milan, he had never served in the church in any official capacity. He hadn't even been baptized yet. Young Ambrose was sent to Rome to get the full classical education, and he excelled in every subject he touched: grammar, rhetoric, law, philosophy, whatever. We don't have good records for what he did after he came of age, beyond the fact that he established a reputation for himself of being a brilliant orator and an excellent lawyer. We next find him in the early 370s being appointed consular prefect of the northern Italian administrative districts of Emilia and Liguria. This prefecture just so happened to be headquartered in Milan, which meant that Ambrose, now in his mid to late 30s, became well known to the court of Valentinian, and his political future looked bright. He was popular with the people, respected by his peers, and marked for promotion by his superiors. But then his life and career and world history took an unexpected turn. In 374, the sitting bishop of Milan died. Now, the sitting bishop just so happened to have been of Arian persuasion, which had rankled the majority Nicene population of the city. Now that the bishop was dead, this majority naturally wanted the next bishop to be chaste, moral, and above all, a staunch Nicene. But the Arian minority population, who just so happened to be supported by Valentinian's wife Justina, wanted the next bishop to be an Arian, just like the old bishop had been. And so the Christian population of Milan started a fight with itself, and of course, no one was willing to give an inch. In his capacity as consular prefect, Ambrose showed up on the day that the new bishop was to be elected, with the sole objective of keeping the peace. He had reason to believe he might be able to keep a lid on things, since he was respected by both sides. Though a Nicene by disposition, Ambrose had always been tolerant of Arianism in his role as prefect, and so everyone saw him as an honest broker. When the election started to get out of hand, Ambrose stepped in to see if he couldn't settle everyone down. And then, someone in the crowd had a bright idea, and they shouted, "Ambrose for bishop." This cry was then taken up by the whole assembly. Everyone suddenly agreed that Ambrose was the perfect compromise candidate. Everyone, that is, except Ambrose himself, who begged and pleaded with the crowd to please think up a different solution. He knew no theology, he was no priest, he hadn't even been baptized yet. But the calls for his elevation persisted. So Ambrose did the prudent thing. He hightailed it out of there and went into hiding. A week later, he was still in hiding when a message signed by the young emperor Gratian began making the rounds. Apparently, the emperor fully supported the wise decision to make the eminently capable consular prefect bishop. Ambrose was stuck, and he knew it. So he came out of hiding, went and got baptized, and became the new Bishop of Milan. An unconventional path to the cloth for sure, but once he got there, boy howdy did he ever make the most of it. Now on a normal day, being the Bishop of Milan meant having a healthy degree of influence. After all, you were the most powerful Christian official in the most important imperial capital in the Western Empire. But after just a year in office, it stopped being a normal day for Ambrose. Because in 375, Valentinian I suddenly died, and his youngest son, Valentinian II, was elevated to the rank of Augustus. When the imperial court had left Milan in 374 heading east, it had been led by a domineering general who had been in office for more than a decade. When it returned, it was led by a four-year-old. Now, for a variety of reasons, the Roman imperial system rarely strayed into child emperors, which meant that when it did, there was no agreed-to precedent for how to handle the situation. Basically, that meant that a variety of powerful ministers would jockey with each other for power until a few emerged triumphant from the back rooms as the de facto heads of state. In the case of young Valentinian II, the emergent leaders of the Milan court turned out to be the Empress Justina and the hugely popular and supremely capable new Bishop of Milan, who managed to talk his way right into the heart of the imperial government. This is interesting for its own sake, but it's also interesting because Justina was a staunch Arian, while Ambrose was an Orthodox Nicene. If you don't think the fact that the two most powerful figures in Milan are on opposite sides of a hugely contentious religious feud is going to cause problems, well, you just don't know highly contentious religious feuds. But wait, you say, I thought Ambrose was sympathetic to the Arians. I thought he was an honest broker. Well, yes, he was, when he was consular prefect. But now that he was bishop, he felt he had an obligation to defend the one true faith with every means at his disposal. Almost overnight, Ambrose became a Nicene extremist. But Ambrose's influence did not stop at the city limits of Milan. The bishop's silver tongue began to influence the religious policies of the not much more than a boy himself, Emperor Gratian. This meant, first of all, that the previously ambivalent Gratian adopted Nicene Christianity, but it also meant, second of all, that Ambrose's strong anti-pagan views began to show up in imperial edicts being issued from Gratian's court in Trier. Though most of the high officials, leading ministers, top generals, and even rank-and-file troops had come over to Christianity in the last 50 years, the rural areas of the empire were still mostly untouched by the urban Christian revolution. And down in Rome, the old Italian senatorial class was still fiercely committed to their traditional religions. Since the days of Constantine, the emperors had adopted a policy of indifference toward the paganism of the rural poor and a policy of toleration toward the paganism of the Italian aristocracy. The former posed no political threat and so could be safely ignored, while the latter posed such a political threat that it was better to let sleeping dogs lie. But the bold and ambitious Ambrose decided that that wasn't good enough. Either Christianity was the truth, or it was not. If it was, then why do we tolerate demonic paganism in any form? And if it was not, then what are we doing here? So, at Ambrose's prodding, Gratian started to come down hard on Roman paganism, targeting previously untouchable institutions like the priesthood of Jupiter and the Vestal Virgins. These were the zero-hour foundational cults of Rome that were the bedrock of Roman civilization. They predated the Republic, for crying out loud. Gratian ignored the pleas of the Italians and ordered all public financing for the cults cut off. Starved of funding, these ancient priesthoods would limp on for a few more years until Theodosius would finally put them out of their misery once and for all. But the most controversial anti-pagan edict that Gratian issued came in 382, when the emperor ordered the Altar of Victory removed from the Senate House. The famous gold statue of the winged Nike had been captured by the Romans way back during their war with Pyrrhus and installed in the Senate House by Octavian to celebrate his victory at Actium. The statue was widely seen as the personification of Rome's imperial power. To remove it was not just a question of sacrilege, it was a question of national security. A passionate debate erupted between Ambrose and Symmachus, the most powerful individual senator of the day, which ended, of course, with victory for Ambrose. The altar was removed. Now, the Altar of Victory would be restored during the short, unrecognized reign of Eugenius, but it would be removed again by Theodosius when he captured control of the whole empire, this time for good. There are a good half-dozen places in history we can point to and say this is when the Western Roman Empire ended. The ascension of Diocletian in 284, the triumph of Constantine in 324, the sack of Rome in 410, the sack of Rome in 455, the expulsion of Romulus Augustulus in 476. Everyone seems to have their own pet moment that they like to point to. For those inclined toward superstition, a favorite pet moment to point to is right here, when the Altar of Victory was removed from the Senate House in 382. After all, given what happened next, it is hard not to draw some pretty heavy conclusions about the magical powers of the Altar of Victory. While it stood, Rome was strong and unconquered. When it was removed, Rome was sacked for the first time in 800 years, and then it was sacked again. Less than 100 years later, the Rome that had been the mistress of the world for 1,000 years was gone. Coincidence? You tell me. Just as an aside, I always thought the Altar of Victory, whose fate is officially unknown, would have made a great centerpiece for that long-awaited fourth Indiana Jones movie. But in the end, I guess they decided that it was better to leave the series as a trilogy rather than ruin it with an incoherent crap fest that was as dumb as it was stupid. For that, I salute Mr. Spielberg and Mr. Lucas for putting their commitment to quality filmmaking ahead of their desire to make a boatload of cash. Anyway, in the midst of the fight over the Altar of Victory, there was one other little development that deserves to be mentioned. In his defense of the altar, Symmachus argues that despite the religious transformations of the last 50 years, the emperor was still Pontifex Maximus, and as such, he had a duty to protect these ancient pagan symbols of Rome. It was a fine argument, but one countered easily by Ambrose. The bishop advised Gratian to simply renounce the title Pontifex Maximus, bringing an end to yet another bedrock institution of imperial power, and one that had been around almost as long as the altar had stood in the Senate House. This renunciation also had the sly effect of ending the official unification of religion and government in the person of the emperor, leading to a whole new era in the West where the head of the church and the head of the state were no longer the same man, which, as you can imagine, had some pretty far-reaching consequences. So this is where things stood as Theodosius wound down the Gothic War. Ambrose was ascendant, the last vestiges of paganism were under attack, Gratian was unpopular with the troops, the Arian Empress Justina held sway over the now 12-year-old Valentinian II, the Nicene Theodosius was establishing himself as a peacetime ruler of the East, and up in Britain, Maximus, longtime ally of the Theodosian family, was considering revolt. Everyone had an agenda, everyone had an angle, and everyone was about to get thrown into the hopper to see who came out the other side. In 383, the hopper was turned on when Maximus's troops spontaneously hailed their general as Augustus. Unlike previous revolts that we've seen in the West, those of, say, Postumus or Carausius, Maximus was not acting out of local interest. He had no intention of setting up some splinter kingdom in the hopes of better addressing some crisis. He was making a good old-fashioned play at ruling the whole empire. Well, the western half of it, anyway. So, of course, that meant immediately pulling up almost all the British troops and sailing off with them for Gaul to track down the emperor and overthrow him. You think this might have a negative effect on the Roman ability to hold on to the island? Yeah, me too. Gratian was down in northern Italy when he learned that Maximus was in revolt. Reinforcing the image that he was not a real soldier, the emperor was in the middle of preparing for a military campaign into Raetia when he got the news. Wait, what? I thought Gratian wasn't into soldiering. And now he's... So wait a minute. How much of his reputation is based on truth, and how much is based on slander? Well, that's a really good question. He was abandoned pretty quickly by his men, though, so maybe it wasn't all slander. But honestly, I don't think anyone knows what the hell is really going on here, why people hated Gratian, and why they turned on him so quickly. Gratian took the army he had gathered to fight the Germans and instead marched them north into Gaul to face Maximus. The two armies met near Paris in mid-August 383, where they spent 5 days maneuvering around each other. None of the soldiers had any interest in actually fighting a battle, and it quickly became apparent that this was going to be solved in the tents rather than in the field. After the fifth day, a squadron of elite cavalry defected to Maximus. Shortly thereafter, the great general Maributus, the man who had raised up Valentinian II, was convinced, or bribed, or whatever, to cross the line as well. Then the floodgates opened. Pretty soon, Gratian was standing alone. He fled with his entourage south to Lyon, where the plan was probably for him to sail to Italy. But for some reason he lingered in the city, which allowed Maximus's men to catch up to him. Gratian was betrayed into their hands and unceremoniously executed. He was 24 years old, and though he had technically been in Augustus for 16 years, only for the last 8 of those years had he truly been a ruler. At the end of the day, no one knows why he was abandoned so easily by his men, or why loyalty to the House of Valentinian was so quickly cast aside. Next week, though, we will find at least one man in the empire who was not so ready to discard his loyalty to the ruling dynasty, the Emperor Theodosius. It would have been easy for him to accept Maximus, but he simply couldn't bring himself to endorse the patently illegal revolt and the shocking regicide that went with it. He had neither the men nor the resources to do anything about it just then. But from the get-go, it appears that Theodosius's mind was made up. Maximus would have to answer for his crimes, and if that meant civil war, then so be it.